Is ISIS defeated or not? Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. ISIS may be on the ropes in Syria, but it's not out. And the group still has bank accounts.
And so it has more than enough for a quote-unquote rainy day fund to wage a low-level insurgency in and around parts of Syria and Iraq for the better part of the next decade.
Also, President Trump and his predecessors have declared many national emergencies. 31 of them are still ongoing. So who decides when they're over? Plus, my conversation with Ada Hegerberg, the first woman ever to win soccer's prestigious award, the Ballon d'Or.
Obviously, it's an individual trophy, but it's still a symbol because we're talking about women's football. That's basically the biggest sport in the world.
Those stories and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us this Friday. American troops are coming home from Syria. That message came from a U.S. military spokesman today. Without giving details, he said the withdrawal has begun. The Pentagon says about 2,000 American troops are fighting in Syria. It could take months for the pullout to be completed, but today's announcement makes sense in light of these words from the commander-in-chief on December 19th.
I've been president for almost 2 years, and we've really stepped it up. And we have won against ISIS. We've beaten them, and we've beaten them badly. We've taken back the land, and now it's time for our troops to come back home.
That's President Trump speaking in a video from the White House less than a week before Christmas, declaring victory over ISIS. Since then, there have been contradictory statements from administration officials at the highest level. Just one example, yesterday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the fight against ISIS continues and that America won't stop until ISIS is defeated and Iran driven out of Syria.
President Trump has made the decision to bring our troops home from Syria. We always do. And now is the time. But this isn't a change of mission. We remain committed to the complete dismantling of ISIS, the ISIS threat, and the ongoing fight against radical Islamism in all of its forms.
Mia Bloom, professor at Georgia State University, you've written several books on terrorism and violent extremism. What do you make of all these contradicting statements? Is ISIS defeated?
ISIS has territorially lost about 98% of what it held in 2014 and 2015. So that's definitely a positive. The last fighting that we saw was around Hajin, in which the U.S. was able to capture Hajin on the Euphrates. But the response from ISIS was to claim the December 2018 attack at the Strasbourg Christmas market. So while ISIS might be defeated in the region, this has inadvertently created incentives for ISIS to flex its muscles in other parts of the world. And at the same time, about 6,000 or 7,000 of those ISIS fighters that were in Syria have moved to other places in the region. So it's just shifted the focus of potential problems.
Right, that Christmas market in Strasbourg in France. Let me bring Colin Clark into the conversation here. He's with the security consulting firm, the Soufan Group. Colin, you specialize in terrorist financial networks. What is ISIS's financial situation right now?
Well, at one point it was accurate to call ISIS the richest terrorist group in the world. But I think, you know, media and even those of us terrorism scholars tend to focus too much on the group's credits, that is, the money that the group has coming in. We don't focus enough on the group's debits. So even while the group is under siege and, as Mia pointed out, has lost approximately 99% of its territory, what that means to me is that it's got less money that it needs to spend on infrastructure and on governance. And so it has more than enough for a quote-unquote rainy day fund to wage a low-level insurgency in and around parts of Syria and Iraq for the better part of the next decade.
Yeah, I mean, reporting in the Washington Post suggests that maybe ISIS has access to billions in cash. Is that accurate?
The numbers are really tough to pinpoint. Billions might be overstating it, but even if it's hundreds of millions, I've seen the number 400 million, that's a lot of money for a group that tends to operate on a shoestring. It's way more money than any insurgent group would need.
All right, let's put a pin in the finances. We'll come back to that. Mia, the Trump administration is saying that it's pulling out of Syria, but that it will continue to work to defeat ISIS there. Can the U.S. do both and do them both effectively?
It's a challenge because I don't think that Erdogan in Turkey is a particularly reliable ally, although he states that, you know, he won't attack. The only thing that has prevented Turkey from attacking the Kurds, and the Kurds have been one of our most reliable allies in the region in terms of fighting ISIS, has been the presence of U.S. troops. And so I think that it's very difficult to pull out and continue to protect the Kurds. And we've kind of screwed over the Kurds in the past. We've made promises to the Kurdish communities for, you know, 25 years for protection. And when push comes to shove, we've left them holding the bag.
I would echo Mia's point. It's not only a matter of will for the Turks fighting against the Kurds or fighting against the Islamic State, which is very much in question as the Kurds tend to be Erdogan's primary target. It's also a matter of capability. You know, so fighting a two-front war is something that even the Turkish military, which is highly regarded, there are questions about the ability to do that. And that says nothing of ISIS networks that stretch across the border into Turkey itself, sleeper cells, and other militants that look to take advantage of Turkey's communication, infrastructure, financial networks.
Speaking, I would add one more thing
go ahead, Mia.
To what Colin was saying, sorry, is that, you know, we know, for example, the State Department Special Representative for Syria, James Jeffrey, has said one of our policy goals is the departure of all Iranian military and proxy forces from Syria. But if we pull out, we are creating a power vacuum in the region that the Iranians and the Russians are most likely going to fill. So I think it runs counter to U.S. national interests if one of the major interests is to contain Iranian power.
Picking up on the sleeper cell thing, Mia, in the absence of territory in Iraq and Syria, what is your sense of ISIS recruitment in places like Europe and the U.S. right now?
Well, it's unclear as to whether the fighters who were in Syria are more dangerous than the ones who never went and might have been disillusioned. So I think there is definitely always going to be the threat of the so-called lone actor or people who are inspired by ISIS. But I think it's very important to your listeners to disaggregate and to differentiate between those plots that are directly sponsored and orchestrated by ISIS versus those that might just be inspired. The inspired plots are going to be impossible to prevent because any idiot can just say, I'm with ISIS, and the media tends to give ISIS credit for the attack, when in fact that might not actually be the case.
But in terms of actual ISIS kind of organized plots and stuff, I mean, Colin, how portable are the finances of ISIS right now? Because al-Qaeda was able to stage 9/11 for under $500,000.
Yeah, well, we've learned a lot of lessons, you know, in the counter-threat finance realm since 9/11. I actually wrote a book called Terrorism, Inc. in 2015, looking at a lot of the countermeasures put in place. We made it incredibly difficult for terrorists and insurgents to use the licit financial system. We have seen some examples of the Islamic State sending money to its affiliates abroad. We saw, you know, some money being used to fund the siege of Marawi in the Philippines. Will we see more of that? Most likely. But it's very difficult to use the licit financial system now because of all the, you know, rules that have been put in place since 9/11.
But many of these attacks that are going to happen abroad are not particularly expensive to carry out. It really doesn't take a lot of money to ram a truck into a group of people. And so that ultimately is the greatest danger, is that regardless of what ISIS finances are in the future, that people who are going to be inspired to do something horrible in the name of ISIS can do so at very low cost.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And in fact, Magnus Ransdorp wrote a piece for CTC Sentinel called Microfinancing the Caliphate, where he talked about various ways in which aspiring militants raised funds and very small amounts of money through things like fraud, various types of insurance schemes. So scraping together a few thousand dollars, especially if you're not worried about ruining your credit, is not very difficult to do.
I've been speaking with Colin Clark with the Sufan Group, where he specializes in terrorist financial networks, and with Mia Bloom, a professor at Georgia State University who studies terrorism and violent extremism. Mia, Colin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
The government shutdown drags on, but a president tells his people that he's standing his ground. Yeah, that sounds like the U.S., but that's a story from south of the border, too. In Mexico, lots of motorists are lining up at gas stations. The new Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has been shutting down state-run gasoline pipelines. It's his response to the problem of fuel theft. His shutdown is also controversial, as reporter Emily Green tells us from Mexico City.
I am hearing that there are just hundreds, perhaps thousands of people around the country waiting in long lines to just try and get a little gas in their cars. I talked to one man in Guadalajara today, and he said that people are getting up at 4 a.m. to get in line to get gas in their vehicle, and sometimes they're not even managing to do that. So this, I think, is a practical crisis, and it's also a political crisis for Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who just took office in December.
And is this happening also in the capital of Mexico City?
Yes, it's happening in Mexico City as well. The mayor here estimates that about a quarter of gas stations are affected by this crisis.
So the new president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has been shutting down these gasoline pipelines. Is that part of the problem here? And why did he do that?
Right. The backdrop to this crisis is the fact that gas theft is a major, major problem in Mexico. It has been for many years now. It's estimated that state-run energy company Pemex loses around $3.5 billion a year in gas theft. And so what the new president wants to do is he wants to crack down on that, and he wants to close the pipelines so he can deal with a theft problem. And so he's basically using massive tanker trucks to transport the gas. But tanker trucks are big, but they don't make up for a pipeline.
So when these thieves are stealing oil, they're siphoning it off these fuel pipelines. Is a sense that by shutting these pipelines down, this might actually stop the thieves?
That's the calculation of trying to shut down the pipelines, I think, get to the crux of the problem.
But does President Obrador have the support of the public on this?
So in theory, yes, the Mexican public is not a fan of gas theft. They want that stopped, the country losing billions of dollars a year because of it. In practicality, do Mexicans want to be waiting in line since 4 in the morning to get gas in their vehicles or not be able to get gas at all? No. And so this, I think, is a real risk for López Obrador. Yes, he wants to get rid of gas theft, but he is rapidly going to lose public support if this crisis continues. And I think it's going to be a real dilemma for him to see how this plays out and what to do.
Any sense of how long this shutdown is going to go on for, this gasoline pipeline shutdown? And is gasoline just going to be moved by truck from now on?
Initially, López Obrador's administration said it would last around 5 days. Then he came out swinging and said it would basically – he wasn't going to back down and he would keep the pipeline shut down as long as needed. And I think now they're backtracking a little bit because they see that this is turning into a real crisis for López Obrador. So by Monday or Tuesday, we'll know more.
Any possibility this could all be felt north of the border?
Yes, it's definitely possible that this gas crisis could be felt north of the border, and that's because there's a lot of trade and commerce between the U.S. and Mexico, and a lot of that trade happens via truck. So if you are sending goods from the U.S. to Mexico and your big four-wheeler or your 16-wheeler can't get gas, how are they going to get that merchandise to Mexico? So this could have an impact beyond just here in Mexico.
A shutdown of a different kind in Mexico, a gasoline pipeline shutdown. Reporter Emily Green in Mexico City. Thanks very much, Emily.
Thank you.
Coming right up, she's the best soccer player there is. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. The Wall of Fame for Ada Hegerberg is filling up fast with honors. She's a professional soccer player from Norway. Hegerberg and her teammates at Olympique Lyonnais in France are the reigning champions of Europe. And on a personal level, Ada Hegerberg is a Ballon d'Or winner. The Ballon d'Or is one of soccer's most prestigious awards. It's been given to men for years by the French magazine France Football. Just last month, though, Hegerberg became the first woman to be given the prize. It was a huge deal in the world of soccer, and as Hegerberg told me, it was also a great opportunity to send an empowering message to girls worldwide.
I think it was the perfect timing to make a statement, and that was important for me as well. And it was only like small words that means a lot to many, but having self-belief and courage to work hard to achieve your dreams. I know the importance of having role models to look up at, and that timing couldn't be better to send that message.
So the timing, because the timing of the Ballon d'Or and you're receiving it, or the timing of just kind of a movement around the globe? I mean, I'm thinking of the Me Too movement and what that's kind of led to.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially that it's been two quite intense years speaking about Me Too movement and equality. I'm born in Norway, where equality is such an important subject for all of us. And you can't miss that part, playing football as well. Growing up, being a professional today, you can't miss that part. I also got the question earlier this week, like, are you a feminist or are you a football player? And I mean, of course, I'm a football player, but of course, I'm fighting for equality as well, because you can't miss that part when you're in sports.
After you won the award, Ada, you said that it's important for girls and young women to believe in themselves. I want us to hear just a moment of what you said.
Obviously, when you see a Ballon d'Or trophy for the women's yesterday on telly and you're, yeah, I don't know, 10 years old, you must be inspired.
Yeah, for sure. why do you think that kind of representation is important for girls and young women?
I just think it's a symbol in itself. It shows that someone came up on the pitch and decided to get this award finally. We were in 2018, so it took some time, but France Football made a decision having this award for women as well, and that's a huge step forward. And obviously, it's an individual trophy, but it's still a symbol, because we're talking about women's football. That's basically the biggest sports in the world, and it shows that we're going in some right direction as well.
Were there football players, soccer players, as we say, who inspired you? And were there women in that group?
Yeah, man. I mean, that was the hard part, because when I was growing up, there was so little media and so little people covering women's football. So it was never on the telly, for example, except the big tournaments as the World Cup and the Euros, maybe. So I was watching men's football all my youth. And today, I think that's changed a lot. And only that is so positive. And I think I remember watching the World Cup in 2011, for example, and I was so motivated, so inspired by that tournament. And
the Women's World Cup?
Yeah, in 2011. That was a great World Cup. And that gave me that little push to keep going. So today, it's a lot different, but it also has to develop even more, getting the media on the road, covering even more women's football.
Do you remember watching Bend It Like Beckham?
Yeah, obviously, like every other girl in my age, it was what a movie. It sounds like a cliche, but that was a movie that made me make the push forwards.
You're kind of at the top already at 23, playing pro soccer for Olympique Lyonnais. It's one of the top soccer clubs for women in the world. It's in Lyon, in France. What did it take for you to get there, and how hard was that?
A lot of work. I think you need to be tough mentally to get a certain point like that. Yeah, I kind of grew up in a football family, so they kind of been with me along the way. And tough days, of course, but at the same time, I'm privileged to be in the place I am today. But it takes a lot of commitment, I would say.
Now, I just want to mention at the ceremony last month where you were awarded the Ballon d'Or, it was marred by what a lot of people have described as a sexist comment made by the DJ who was hosting the show.
Est-ce que tu sais twerker?
Non.
Very awkward and frankly painful moment. He asked you if you could twerk. You said that you didn't think of it as sexual harassment at the moment because obviously you were accepting the highest award in soccer. What do you think about the situation now?
No, I'm going to be honest with you. I was totally turning that question down because I was never in my mind of twerking in front of millions of people. But
right. I mean, why would you?
Exactly. So I think it was an unfortunate moment for him, even though if he would ask that question to me or Mbappe or Modric, it was just not. It was a bad timing for a question like that. But I was just in the sky had the Ballon d'Or and was blown away by that moment. So it didn't kind of take the attention from the real thing. But I know it got messy and social media and people reacted a lot. And I think that's fine because that means that people are on their toes as well. And that's different today because it's not acceptable to say anything in 2019. And I accept that.
How do you deal with any sexism you've encountered as a woman in soccer?
You can't miss it. You can't miss it. It's everywhere, to be honest. And then it's not only in sports or football. It's around the world. And that's some things that lays close to me, you could say. You can't miss it. And
does that mean it's a constant battle for you?
I would say it's a constant battle for all of us, all girls and women. And it's all about taking responsibility, standing up for ourselves. And everyone can make a difference, I feel. Growing up in Norway with democracy and equality is something that I brought with me out in Europe as well, in the world. So it's something I'm going to have a passion for all my life.
We're speaking with Ada Hegerberg, who is the first woman to win a Ballon d'Or, making her this year's best soccer player in the world among women. Your sister also plays soccer professionally, I see. What was that like growing up with someone who is also talented? Did it become a rivalry with you two?
It meant everything, to be honest. I had a biggest sister that pushed me. She's in PSG today, which is quite surreal for both of us on the highest level. And it's quite surreal for our parents as well. But we've been pushing each other, supporting each other since we were little kids. And she always was there to help me, and we're still buddies, best buddies today, and sisters, so we have a special bond.
That's great. Do you ever find yourself playing against each other on the pitch?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, it's hard for our parents.
But, is it hard for you? That's the question.
It's quite easy for us, because when we step on that pitch, we're just so mentally in it, and we're just there for the win, you know? So when we step off the pitch again, it's completely fine. But when it gets down to business, we're here to win, and it should be like that as well. But ask my mom and dad. They've been struggling now for 1 year.
So aside from being named the top woman soccer player in the world, what has been your best moment as a soccer player?
I would say winning the Champions League. I've been lucky to win it 3 times with Lyon, and what we achieved the last years is historical. So that's quite big to me, and I hope to win as many as possible before my career is done.
Yeah, well, a few more would be just cherry on the cake, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. Crossing fingers.
Ada Hegerberg, professional soccer player for Olympique Lyonnais in France. She is the first woman to win the Ballon d'Or. Ada, great to meet you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you guys as well.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump now says he's not rushing to declare a national emergency over the border wall. But did you know there are 31 other emergencies in effect right now?
Presidents find the powers that they have under them necessary, and it's easier to just keep renewing the emergencies than to get Congress to pass legislation.
That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We are in a national emergency, actually more than 24 of them. Serious. I'm not talking about Donald Trump declaring a national emergency to get his border wall built. Trump said today he's not going to do that immediately. He will leave it to Congress. But here's something you might not realize. We took a tally, and there are currently 31 national emergencies still active. President Trump declared 3 of them. Before that, Barack Obama put 9 in place. The oldest active one goes back to Jimmy Carter. So how does a national emergency actually work? Is it an exclusive power of the presidency, or does Congress have a say? Andrew Boyle is with the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law.
Unfortunately, Congress does not have to be involved in continuing declarations of national emergency. The president is required to renew national emergencies every year or they automatically expire.
Yeah, you say unfortunately Congress isn't involved. Why do you think that's unfortunate?
My view and the view of the Brennan Center is that over the years, the Congress has not done its work that it needs to do in order to ensure that it operates sufficient oversight of the president's ability to declare a national emergency and to use emergency powers. One fix to that would be to set up a regime for example, where the president is allowed to initially declare a national emergency, and then it's incumbent on Congress to renew those national emergencies after a certain amount of time.
Yeah, so there are a number, I mean, close to over 30 national emergencies that are still in effect. So what does that mean? Are they all ongoing and still active? And if they're not, why was the original declaration not rescinded?
Yeah. So since the National Emergencies Act took effect in 1978, there have been a large number of national emergencies declared. And as you noted, 31 of them are still in effect. Some of them have been rescinded since that time. And they are essentially renewed every year. The longest running one is since 1979, has been renewed every year because presidents find the powers that they have under them necessary. And it's easier to just keep renewing the emergencies than to get Congress to pass legislation.
Yeah, that one in 79, that was under Jimmy Carter, blocking Iranian government property.
That's correct.
Yeah, and there are a number of other national emergencies that seem kind of arcane in their detail, like blocking of property of certain persons who have interests in Somalia or Burundi or Libya. I mean, who's paying attention to these?
Well, we would argue not enough people. I think one benefit of the president's threat to use national emergency powers to build his wall is that this has brought to the attention of many more people the potential for abuse that these powers represent.
I've read that there are some experts saying that if he does declare a national emergency to pay for this wall, there's a possibility that it could be appealed or taken to court. Has that ever happened with other declarations of national emergencies, that there's been an appeal?
There have been other arguments regarding national emergency powers, because the National Emergencies Act, under its language, actually requires Congress to meet every 6 months to consider whether the emergency should be rescinded or not. And they have never done that. And there was a challenge at one point by someone who was affected by one of these national emergency powers to say that the power was no longer legitimate because the Congress has never met under these provisions. And the court, this was the First Circuit Court of Appeals, essentially said that it was not mandatory that Congress meet. If they want to meet, they can. And in fact, they never have. I think it's clear that there would be litigation that would be brought if the president were to declare a national emergency to try and build his wall.
We're about to meet a journalist on the show, Andrew. He's from Nicaragua and fearing for his safety. He's in exile right now. I mention this because just about 2 months ago, another national emergency was declared involving Nicaragua. How have you come to understand this declaration declared by Trump?
Under a provision called the International Economic Emergency Economic Powers Act, which the president is required to declare a national emergency to use those powers. And in fact, those powers under what is known as IEPA is the most frequent use of powers. And they're used to target individuals around the world that are involved in human rights abuses, et cetera. And many of them are ones that, you know, as an individual, I can say I get behind. The problem arises when emergency powers are used to distort the way that government is supposed to operate. And they are used to try and circumvent, or potentially used to try and circumvent, Congress.
Andrew Boyle with the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program at New York University. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
For a full list of declared U.S. emergencies since the Carter administration, including the 31 active ones, just go to theworld.org. As we just heard, President Trump declared an emergency regarding Nicaragua. The U.S. has been very critical of President Daniel Ortega's government and its ongoing crackdown on dissent. One of the government's targets, the independent news media. Reporter Maria Bacalapolo has a story of one outspoken journalist from Nicaragua who was targeted for arrest.
Jaime Arellano has been living out of a suitcase for the last month. He's a heavyset man who suffers from migraines and high blood pressure. He came to Miami with his son to get medical treatment, but then police stormed his workplace in Managua, the TV news station, 100% Noticias.
They ordered a capture for myself and all the journalists at the channel, and they captured the owner of the channel, Miguel Mora, and the chief of staff of the journalist, Lucia Pinedo-Wow, which they are in jail right now.
According to Arellano and media reports, the journalists were accused of inciting hate and violence. Arellano says he refuses to be intimidated.
The only crime that we commit, that we let the people know in Nicaragua and outside Nicaragua, the reality that the people of Nicaragua are suffering in the hands of the dictatorship Ortega, which are killing people.
Ortega was a leader of Nicaragua's Sandinista Revolution 4 decades ago. He returned to power in 2007 and has been president ever since. In that time, he's also appointed his wife as vice president, and his party scrapped term limits on the presidency. Last April, hundreds of thousands of Nicaraguans took to the streets, demanding an end to Ortega's regime. Their protests were met with brutal force. Human rights groups say at least 300 protesters have been killed, with more in jail or missing. Last month, the U.S. imposed sanctions on Nicaraguan officials for violent repression of protesters. Despite the crackdown, protests continue.
There's 100 people, 1,000 people, the young guy, the woman, the rural people, the private sector, the Catholic, the evangelic, they all together fighting against Ortega.
Arellano says he's been a vocal critic since Ortega returned to power.
So I started denouncing him. I started denouncing the corruption. I started to motivate people not to settle, and we can demand change.
His political program featured a variety of guests, from economists to politicians. The weekly TV show had more than 1 million viewers. Ortega has blamed non-state-run media for fomenting civil unrest. But 100% Noticias didn't budge. They kept broadcasting, including Arellano's show.
The government started going after us, have military outside the TV station, military people outside our house. They follow us. They detain us for like an hour.
For now, Arellano is on a 90-day visitor's visa to the U.S. He says he's going to stick around in Miami for a while longer.
I'm not thinking of going back right now because they had told me if I go to the airport, I'm going right to jail. And I think I can serve more outside than in jail right now.
Buenos días, amigos nicaragüenses. Buenos días.
From Miami, Arellano continues to criticize Daniel Ortega on YouTube and on live Facebook feeds that draw thousands of viewers.
Lo que estamos luchando por la esta revolución cívica y pacífica.
We are fighting for the revolution, he says. We are winning. The world and Latin American countries are clearly condemning President Ortega for the massacre and oppression of Nicaraguans. Arellano says even in exile, he will not be quieted. For the world, I'm Maria Bacalopolo in Miami.
Let's face it, Canadians have a reputation. They're about as friendly as can be, but relations between Canada and China have suddenly become very unfriendly. The Chinese ambassador in Canada just accused Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government of white supremacy. The reason? Trudeau demanded that Beijing release 2 Canadians detained in China last month. The two are Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor. They were detained after the arrest in Canada of Meng Wanzhou, an executive for the Chinese tech giant Huawei. She was arrested at the request of the U.S. Jeremy Nuttall is the lead investigative reporter for The Star Vancouver. He spent 4 years reporting in China before returning home, where he focuses on China's influence in Canada. So how off the rails are Canadian-Chinese relations right now?
Really off the rails. It's something that I think that Trudeau is really, really sweating. This is a prime minister who has, you know, based so much of his foreign policy around China, particularly for trade, and was pushing for a free trade agreement with China, and China was pushing for a free trade agreement with Canada. I mean, Canadians already weren't really very warm to that idea in the first place. And now all of this, I think, has really made it impossible for Trudeau to get something like that done. People are pretty much outraged.
Yeah, he sounds like he's in a hard spot right now. I mean, presumably under pressure to intervene on behalf of Kovrig and Spavor.
It's not just the pressure, too. I think it's also like, you know, Canada has had a very long history of, frankly, just naivete when it comes to China. The Canadian public and the Canadian government and Canadian diplomats even seem to think that all we have to do is play nice and we can get China to open up when it comes to human rights and things like that. And that's just not going to happen. And there's been this very go-along-to-get-along attitude from the Canadian government for some time. And Canadians have been kind of indifferent to the whole thing, But I think this has really woken them up to how this regime actually operates. And I don't think that the Chinese government is going to be able to come back from this in the eyes of the Canadian public.
What do you know about the conditions of their detention of Spavor and Kovrig?
We don't know much about what's going on with Kovrig and Spavor, but Kovrig has had his second visit from a consular official just yesterday.
Oh, so they have been visited by officials from the embassy.
Yes, yes, they have. But the actual details of how they're being held have not been divulged by the Canadian side or the Chinese side.
So there's Kovrig and Spavor. How many Canadians have been detained in China since the arrest in Vancouver of Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou?
Altogether, it's 13, but 8 of them have been released. A lot of it is just sort of very typical stuff. At any given time, there's about 200 Canadians in the legal system in China for various things. There's a lot of Canadians who live in China, particularly Beijing and Shanghai. And so people get into, you know, they get into bar fights or just little things like that. And so there's always a certain amount of Canadians who are at some level of the legal system in China.
Right. But of that number, how many do you suspect are in retaliation for Meng Wanzhou?
I would say that Kovrig and Spavor, I think that those are probably the only two. I think if there was any others, the Chinese government would want that to be known as well. With Kovrig and Spavor, they've actually come out and said that these two people are accused of endangering state security, you know, whereas the other ones, there hasn't been any kind of public announcement like that.
Jeremy, I know you're working on a report about China's use of soft power in affecting Canadian attitudes toward China. What have you found out? And does that kind of trope of naivete run through your conclusions?
It certainly does. Because like, what we've had is there's a woman named Yashu Cao, who's a human rights worker based in Washington, who's told me that Vancouver particularly is the Communist Party's headquarters in North America. And what she means by that is there are a lot of, I don't want to use the word agents, but people who are very willingly doing the bidding of the Chinese government within the Canadian Chinese community in Vancouver.
Which is really large, isn't it?
Very large. Yeah, there's hundreds of thousands in Vancouver alone. And of course, I mean, it's important to distinguish that a lot of them are not in favor of the Chinese government actions. You know, I mean, they left China for a reason. However, the Chinese government makes a lot of efforts to try to control this group of expatriates. They do things like try to get local think tanks on board with them to sort of write papers that support their points of views on certain issues, these sorts of things. And they also try to cozy up to Canadian politicians at all levels. And the prime minister himself was involved in a scandal a few years ago. He was basically caught with Chinese government officials at a very lavish dinner for fundraising. It turned out that a lot of them had connections to the Chinese government or were also just sort of unseemly kind of businessmen. That was the first instance, I think, where Trudeau kind of got a bit of a wake-up call on what he was dealing with. And it's just kind of gone from there.
Are the Chinese at all successful at penetrating Chinese-Canadian media, you know, either propaganda or fake news or anything like that?
Incredibly successful. We've had columnists fired here in Vancouver because the Chinese government has told their publishers to fire them.
That's extraordinary.
It's an incredibly large problem. One thing that you have here going on now, for instance, is WeChat, which is how a lot of Chinese Canadians still get their news, is controlled, you know, more or less by the Chinese government. And so stories that are critical of China are removed from that. It's actually quite difficult, or it can be quite difficult, for Chinese Canadians to get news in Chinese that is critical of the Chinese government still. A lot of the media here, the Chinese media, will just play ball because it's kind of essential to their business model to have the Chinese government, you know, have them as a trusted source because it's how they get invited to networking events. It's how they get advertising, things like that. So, yeah, it's quite a problem.
Jeremy Nuttall, the lead investigative reporter for The Star Vancouver in Canada. He focuses on the influence of China in Canada. Jeremy, really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Here's the situation. An election happens and the nation is shocked by the outcome. Citizens start questioning the results. Protesters hit the streets and other countries start weighing in. Could describe so many elections, but I'm talking about the Democratic Republic of Congo. They held elections on December 30th for a new president, and now, almost 2 weeks later, there's still lots of uncertainty. My BBC colleague Louise Duas has been following the vote and what's happened since. She joins us from Kinshasa. We spoke a week ago, Louise, and the Electoral Commission and the DRC was still counting votes then. The results are out now. What's the news?
So on Thursday, the Electoral Commission announced provisional election results, and they said that Felix Tshisekedi, one of the opposition candidates, won with 7 million votes. Martin Fayulu, another opposition candidate, is just behind with 6.3 million votes. And then the ruling party's candidate, Emmanuel Ramazani Shadari, came in third with 4.3 million votes. But today, Martin Fayulu, so the opposition candidate who came in second, claims that he got more votes, and he's basing that claim on tallies that his party has seen. And so he says that he is going to appeal the results to the Constitutional Court, which will have about a week to deliberate and decide if they want to confirm or cancel these results.
And does he have a point? Is this sour grapes? Or, I mean, do some results show that there are still ballots out there for him?
So the Catholic Church, which is very powerful in this country, they deployed the largest number of election observers on voting day. They're saying that the results announced by the Electoral Commission do not match the results that they have. So there are some questions on whether or not the Electoral Commission's results are credible. The court will now decide whether they want to confirm the results or, as I said, decide to cancel them and potentially ask for new elections to be organized.
Wow, would that really happen?
That is a scenario. So there are three scenarios. The first would be that the court could confirm the results of the Electoral Commission and declare Felix Tshisekedi as winner. The second scenario would be that the court could partially cancel results, do a recount, and then declare a new winner. The third scenario is that the court could cancel the results altogether and ask the Electoral Commission to organize new elections. But it's also important to note that the Constitutional Court has never overturned provisional election results. So if they did, it would be unprecedented.
Yeah, and a lot of democratic hope is riding on this election. So as you say, the Catholic Church is very influential in the DRC. But what is the idea behind the church monitoring elections in the country? Is there a precedent for that?
Yes, there is. They did monitor previous elections, but it's true that they had many more people and more resources this year. And one of the reasons why is because the EU and the US did not have observers this year. And this is not the first time the Catholic Church has historically played a very important role in this country. The church is one of the only institutions that works properly. They have a lot of schools, a lot of hospitals. And so when the church speaks, people listen.
Of the three main candidates going into the election, what are their connections to the outgoing president, Joseph Kabila?
The top three front runners were Felix Tshisekedi, an opposition candidate, Martin Fayulu, another opposition candidate, and Emmanuel Ramazani Shadari, who was the ruling party's candidate, so a close ally to the outgoing president, Joseph Kabila. There have been concerns, rumors in the past few days of a backroom deal between Felix Tshisekedi and the outgoing president, Joseph Kabila. Tshisekedi has denied any kind of deal, but he did say that he was open to talks and that he was preparing a transition of power. There's also parliamentary elections going on, and the ruling party, President Kabila's party, claimed to have won the majority of seats and so are suggesting some kind of power sharing.
The election happened almost 2 weeks ago, more waiting to come now. With all this uncertainty, how are Congolese reacting?
So there were always concerns that a contested result could spark unrest in the country. In 2006 and in 2011, in the last elections, there were violent protests after the publication of results. And we're already seeing reports of violent incidents in a city called Kikwit. 12 people were reportedly killed. There are ongoing demonstrations in several cities. But all parties, including Martin Fayulu, who has lodged this appeal, today he called for calm. I think this is a time most Congolese people are still waiting to see what will happen. There's still some uncertainty on what will happen as we wait for the final results to be announced by the Constitutional Court next week.
I know Kinshasa can be a big party town. Do people kind of like put their plans on hold for Friday nights out when you've got this kind of waiting game?
I think, you know, despite reports of demonstrations and violence in some parts of the country, Kinshasa in general remains quite a party city, this huge capital of 12 million people. So in general, yes, people continue to live their usual lives and go out.
My BBC colleague Louise Douast in Kinshasa with the latest on the election in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Thanks, Louise.
Okay, thanks.
And on that note, we leave you with one of the biggest dance numbers ever to hit the Democratic Republic of Congo, the tune Mario by the late great Congolese rumba singer and guitarist Franco. Except this version that came out several years after Franco's death got a straight-on mambo treatment by the Senegalese band Africando. Still highly danceable. Mario, stop being a playboy and just settle down already. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for making it here today. Have a terrific weekend. Machine mandefu biloko ya bato songisa PRI Public Radio International.